Session number 11740, Mr. Lewis Hoskins, Reel 3.
Yes, if I could just ask you another question. You know, regarding the Marshall team, did you yourself at the time gain any impression about partisanship? You know, did he favour the Kuomintang rather than the communists? Or was he just genuinely?
I don't have any evidence to make a judgment on that. Certainly, I think his intention was to be balanced. My hunch is that both sides thought he was leaning the other way. That's the problem of most negotiators. But I think he was trying to be. Now, one needs to add to that factor the ambassador, because by this time, the American ambassador had been changed. There had been wartime ones. And President Leighton Stewart of Yenching University was asked to be ambassador, a very great scholar and devout Christian and a great educator who knew China intimately well and knew the personalities personally. Many of them had gone to Yenching, had been friends and students of his. He was a very valuable asset to Marshall, who could make up for his own lack of experience in China by consulting with Leighton Stewart. The Kuomintang began to suspect Stewart fairly early as being partisan, and that may have had some psychological effect on the effort. I don't know how to judge that. I knew Leighton Stewart better than I knew Marshall. I regarded his role there as quite balanced and very concerned for peace in China, whatever way it was going to come about. And I saw him over a number of months, so I saw some evidence that he had become quite disgusted with the lack of responsiveness and cooperation and the graft and corruption which he knew so well in the Kuomintang and the national government. He felt there was a brittleness over there. But at the same time, as a Christian, he was apprehensive of Mao Zedong. I think he regarded Zhou Enlai, I've heard him speak favorably of Zhou Enlai, as a great diplomatic, reasonable person. So I think he tried to be balanced, and I think the omission tried to be. But what I sense now, and I was wondering about it at the time, was that both were counting as time on their side that they would win out in the end, and that they were thoroughly convinced that their party and their policy was what China needed. And they were poles apart. And I did see, particularly when I was living in Shanghai, so much evidence that Chiang Kai-shek had, in desperation, in my judgment, tainted his idealism with commitments to the wealthy and the industrial group and the large family names of which he was identified, and had forfeited by doing that any real activity on the part of the national government on behalf of the villagers, the peasants, and even the students. And we could see, I was doing some teaching there in Shanghai, we could see very quickly that he was alienating this bright young student group who lost confidence in the Kuomintang goals and methods and became enamored with what the agrarian reformers of Mao Zedong was carrying out on behalf of their country. And many of them fled into communist territory because they felt rebuffed by the Kuomintang. All of this adds up to, by the spring of 1948, as we were very busy in our medical work and our relief work and so forth, the problems of how were we going to continue to do what we felt called and able to do if the war engulfed us. And that was right in the Yellow River area, because while the Kuomintang nominally held it, the communists were pushing south very, very rapidly. So that made us consider in our FAU meetings, how are we going to establish our neutrality, our integrity, our non-military position with armies, either armies. So we were able to get from General Bai Chung-shi, the head of the Kuomintang, or the national government army in Nanking, passes for our people who were in the area that was likely to be engulfed in the war. And that was, to some extent, helped by our connection with some of the diplomats, British Sir Stevenson, ambassador, and Leighton Stewart, the American ambassador. So those were very helpful for the Kuomintang side. But immediately we said, well, we've got to have the other ones too. And so at that point, I was asked to undertake a mission to find the counterpart. If not the military man, then Deng Biwu, who was the head of the Chinese Liberated Areas Relief Association, under whom our medical work was being carried out, and that we knew that he was in Yunnan or somewhere. And by that time, Yunnan had been recaptured by the communists, but they were very mobile, and nobody could tell you where the government of the Liberated Areas, the communist government, was, except somewhere in the mountains. But we were told to try and find him, and so we started with our field headquarters in Zhengwu on the Yellow River, and went south, because in that flooded area that I mentioned earlier, there was a unique tractor project supported by UNRWA, by the Brethren, the Mennonites, and the Friends, to help in that area that was now flat, the use of small tractors instead of animals. And to carry out, this is our experiment, UNRWA had set up a team of communist and Kuomintang agricultural experts with volunteers helping out. So we knew the Kuomintang chap and we knew the communist chap down there. So we first went down into the heart of the flooded area and asked the communist fellow there whether he would communicate with his headquarters. We figured he had some kind of line of communication, asking for permission for us to go and consult with their authorities wherever they might be, in particularly Deng Biwu. And after some time, that did occur, and we were given that permission. And that was very timely, because the communists were moving right in and the war was engulfing us on all sides sporadically. So on the basis of that permission, we created a team which, besides myself, included a Chinese chap, Henry Yu, a British chap, Charles Cadbury, and an American chap, who also had pretty good language. And this was Mark Shaw on this day. And so we then took our sleeping bags and our backpacks and went down to this tractor station. And after a day, this is unbelievable, but it happened, a small patrol of communist soldiers was assigned to take us to see Deng Biwu, eat up a colonel and some support soldiers. This bothered us, but he said, that's the only way we will invite you in. We've got to protect you. But if you will come with us, we'll get you there. So we started north, and the war blew up in our faces. And we couldn't go, so we backed up. And Colonel Wong then said, there's only one other way to go, and that's circle around the fighting. So there happens to be a troop movement tomorrow morning. Be ready at dawn. And we were. And we had a fascinating morning watching what must have been a rather large group of communist soldiers, the People's Liberation Army, or the Balujin, the Eighth Route Army as it was called, gathered very disciplined way in a bright May morning, coming in meticulously and walking one animal, one horse, and a whole group. There must have been 300 or 400, maybe 500 soldiers. And we brought up the rear with our walks, and they had commandeered a small horse cart for our baggage, so we wouldn't have to carry it all. Soldiers carried theirs. We were favored as foreigners. And so we traveled with the 8th Route Army for 3 days, crossing the railroad track at night, stopping in villages as the soldiers did, and they spread out in various villages so that they wouldn't be too burdening, and took us all the way to Loyang, which was a long, long walk. And then they were going on, and so we broke loose and got up to a road and were able to go north, opposite Handan, down to Handan, and then up to Zhejiang, a total of several hundred miles, probably 700 or 800 miles on that track, and over 2 months' time. But we got to Zhejiang, Dongliwu came, and we talked about medical services, particularly the disease of Kala-Azar, a children's disease along the Yellow River that had become very serious during the war. But was not worried about politics. It worked on both sides, and we wanted to clear the area because it would spread if we couldn't clear it entirely. And so we arranged with that and the possibility of a hospital unit supplementing the International Peace Hospital, and came back, having been gone 3 months, with not individual passes, but with a document signed by Dongliwu, which he permitted us to copy and use individually. So that turned out, in the long run, to be quite a strenuous but a very very successful mission.
And yes, it sounds remarkable, you know, and ironic, really, you know, the fact that there you were going up with the army for, you know, a great part of the way. Yeah. You must have had a very sort of privileged glimpse of the 8th Route Army at that particular time. It was the 8th Route Army.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. Liu Pichang was the general.
What was your opinion of them? You know, you'd obviously seen the Kuomintang troops as
right.
well, and I don't know if you could tell
Well,
me.
Yes. We were actually enjoying ourselves, and we're fascinated by many of these young soldiers. We could talk to them occasionally as we marched along and as we camped, and often in the same villages at night, or stopped for a quick rest or something of the sort. They were on the young side. They were friendly, willing to talk. And the thing that impressed me, two things. One, the discipline. They were very well disciplined. And secondly, they were very psychologically wise in dealing with the local people. They did not exploit, they did not demand. This may be politics or whatnot, but when they'd go in, they would never stay in a village more than a couple, 3 days, because that would be burdening. And they issued receipts for the services rendered, which they said you can turn in when the liberation government comes in as tax already paid. Never seen a Kuomintang even think about doing anything like that. Now, whether it worked or not, I have no idea, but it made an impression. And they all walked. The one soldier that was riding on the horse was injured and wounded or had a bad foot or something. And it wasn't the general whom we expected to be riding the horse. He walked, too. So we were exceedingly well impressed with their light equipment. They all carried guns and their own food supply and their blanket, and that's all. But that was enough. And they would supplement their galleon or millet or whatever they were carrying to cook with local vegetables, which they, as I say, they again would pay for, not to just insist on taking. The Kuomintang story is just about the opposite in terms of relations with the public. And we were beginning to see, not only in that army, but in our work in Yunnan and elsewhere, a striking contrast in the attitude of the two governments towards appealing to the mass population of China. And the Kuomintang was losing the masses, the communists were winning them. It had nothing to do with very little to do with ideology as far as most peasants were concerned. They were not fond of any soldier, but they had a preference very quickly, and we can see that.
When you arrived, you know, at your destination, and you were negotiating, was it with Dongbi Wu?
Yeah.
Dongbi Wu.
Yeah.
How did they go? How did they negotiate? He treat you?
Well, very respectful and very courteously. He's a hard bargainer, but reasonable. And once we had an agreement, he never reneged. We did, because the war prevented us from doing some things we promised to do. But I almost have to tell you the next story, where the negotiations were in some ways more detailed and more complicated. Because that occurred the same year, but a little bit later. The first one was to get our passes, and then we made up, so each people out on the front carried two passes, one in either pocket for either side, whichever one you thought you needed. They all wore the same uniforms, more or less, and you couldn't always be sure. But that was a security protection, which we felt pretty important, and we're relieved to have. When I got back to Shanghai after that long trip and reunited with the family and with the unit and reporting and so forth, it wasn't long, and I think it was a matter of 2 months, until I got a call from the American embassy. Now, Marshall had gone home. The war was in a violent form. The communists were pushing slowly south, but in varying degrees of effectiveness here and there. Warfare. When I got a call from Ambassador Stewart's secretary, he said, the ambassador wants to see you. Can you come to Nanjing right away? And I said, I suppose so. I said, well, there's a plane waiting at the airport if you can catch it. Get a taxi and come on. This was in July. We'd been gotten back at the end of May or early June. And he said, I've just received a message from Yunnan for you. It has come by way of San Francisco, a report from Yunnan, from Dongbi Wu, directed to you and Dr. Marcel Juno, the head of the International Red Cross. And it's a radio message which has been translated, and it says, Dr. Juno and Mr. Hoskins, will you come to the Yellow River Dike area to witness the atrocities of the Kuomintang air strikes that are threatening to break the dikes again and cause great devastation on the part of the people. This should not be a war objective. Maybe you can help persuade them to stop if you'll come and see for yourself. I talked to Dr. Juno, and he would have nothing to do with it. I said, that's ridiculous. I couldn't think about it. But when I talked to Dr. Stewart, he said, there may be more to it than that. The Chinese are often indirect. And I think you should accept his invitation to come and go talk, see what's on his mind. Maybe it's this. Maybe there's more to it than that. And he said, would you be willing to go back? And I said, thinking of 1,000 miles. Well, if it would help in any way to end suffering, bring peace, of course I will. And so in the end of July, early August, we organized another group. By this time, the communists were much closer to us along the Yellow River, occupied most of the north side.
His 48, is it?
This is August of 48, before we got going. And this time, we decided to take an a vehicle. We were had been given a weapons carrier, of all things, by the UNRWA, which is a big jeep with a little extra space. And we decided, the four of us, essentially the same group, except Mark Shaw was replaced by Frank Miles, but Charles Cadbury from here, working on, and Henry Yu and I made up the group. And so we put our bags into the weapons carrier, put in a barrel of petrol at the back, and started north across the Yellow River Railroad Bridge, fragile though it was, and spent the last night in Kuomintang territory in Sichuan with a Kuomintang general whom we knew very well. And he asked him where we were going, and so we had to be a little bit devious and say, we are investigating the extent of Kalazar in this whole area, and it's, we know there's a lot of it up here, and it'll spread across the river, and whatever. And he gave us a feast and this, that, and other thing. He said, well, you mustn't go north of here. The communists are just up there a little ways, and you know what they'll do to you. You mustn't go. But the next morning we went anyway and got out of Kuomintang territory to the consternation of the guards and just started driving north. Well, we had many incidents and episodes on the way north, partially because there were heavy rains, the roads, whatever they were precarious. We were in no man's land, and our first contact with the communists were doubtful. We kept wanting to make contact because we now had our pass and the invitation, and we thought we weren't worried about it, but still it's nervous to go into that kind of uncertainty. And we would keep asking the villagers whether there were any Eighth Route Army around, and they kept saying no. So we'd go further and further, and finally one of them said, there's a horse up there in that next village. And so we decided that probably was an outpost, and sure enough it was. And so, to make a long story short, we did make contact with this outpost sentry, showed our pass and our letter, and he couldn't read, and he was very anxious. He thought he'd been caught by the whole American army, because it soon became clear that some of us at least were Americans. So I was held hostage while the rest of the team came up, and we made our case, and he finally agreed to take us back to his headquarters. It took a lot of talking and some very interesting palaver while I was hostage. But we made it, and we met his headquarters, and they could read, and immediately passed us on through. When we got to Xochitlwang again, the same place where we expected to meet Dungbi Wu, or he couldn't be, we had the same guest house and person in charge who welcomed us, treated us very well, but unfortunately Dungbi Wu is ill. We don't know how soon he'll feel able to come. But enjoy yourself. So we did. We were well fed. We took hikes in the village and out to the countryside. Several people came in because it was a kind of a center place for the authorities. Dr. Mahaday, the American doctor, came in with his son. Another of our agriculture units that we'd posted in communist territory came in. So we had quite a handful of us and enjoyed ourselves while we were waiting. Kept asking every day, will he come today? Well, maybe. Ming Tian, Ho Tian, next day. One early day, an airplane came over, zigzagging over the whole town of Xochitlwang, obviously taking pictures. And we kind of joked, well, I wonder if that's an American plane, but is it American pilot? If it is, we'll hear from it pretty soon. If it's Kuomintang, we don't know. Well, sure enough, within a week, our house was subject to 2 hours of very severe bombing and strafing, the guest house that we were in, badly damaged. Our truck was hit. And three bullets struck it. The petrol tank was leaking. flat tire and the gasoline, the petrol tank was struck at the edge, but not enough to leak very much. Meantime, we were out in set trenches on the outside, watching these huge planes and fighter planes, both big bombing planes and fighter planes. There were about eight of them, spending 2 hours focusing on our house, the house we were staying in. And we were keeping low in the slit trenches, about 50 yards from the house. Mahade, yes, and our four, and our hosts, and so forth. None of us was hurt. But our host said, we've got to get out of here. They may come back. So we changed tires, plugged the holes, and drove out to a village about 10 miles out away from Church of Chuang. And sat for 2 more days until Deng Biwu came. But because it was now a dangerous area, he came in at 10 o'clock at night and said, thank you for coming, we appreciate it, and we'll stay as long as we can be useful here. But I must get back to my headquarters soon. So we told him that we had been along the Yellow River banks and we'd seen evidence of it, but we'd also seen evidence that the Balijin were using for military movements. I said, we cannot ask that they stop bombing it as long as you use it as a military, for any military purposes. If you declare it neutral and guarantee not to use it in your military purpose, then we can appeal to Kuomintang to do the same, to leave it alone for the sake of the people. So that's a good point. But I can't make that decision, but I will consult, and I think we can probably arrange that. Well, that didn't take very long, although with tea and cakes and interpretation, it went for an hour or two. Then we went ahead and talked about some more medical services that they were requesting from the FAU. Then our team hadn't really consulted on this, but I took the rash lead of saying, Deng Lao, I have another thought I'd like to share with you, we would like to share with you, and that is, here it is, August of 1948, and in a very short time, the world geopolitical situation will alter